Good morning.
Good morning.
The court calls United States v. Coleman.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the courts, may it please the court, I'm Captain Robert Michaels, and together with Colonel Patricia Hamm, I represent the appellant, Specialist Walter Coleman, in this case. This case is about whether the government has met its burden in proving that the non-disclosure was harmless beyond reasonable doubt. This court has recognized in United States v. Roberts that harmless beyond reasonable doubt is a higher standard than merely whether the non-disclosure of evidence would have affected the outcome of the trial. In this case, the military judge failed to properly apply that standard in the context of the motion for mistrial when, one, he shifted the burden to defense to prove that it wasn't harmless beyond reasonable doubt, and two, he failed to consider the prejudicial impact of defense counsel formulating the trial strategy based on that false information. In regards to the first issue, the military judge and the Army Court identified the correct standard but then failed to apply it. They made assumptions in favor of the government, assumptions as to how the government would have responded to an attempt by defense counsel to introduce that clemency agreement had they attempted to use that at trial. But that's where their analysis ended. They failed to consider what defense counsel could have done as well in response. Given that it was the government's burden to prove that it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt, to make assumptions entirely in favor of the government and not to assume defense counsel or competent defense counsel could respond to that was incorrect.
Are you arguing the defense counsel need make no arguments then?
No, sir.
Okay.
See, what happened was that the Army Court and the military judge made assumptions based off of what the government could have done, but also just didn't consider that defense counsel could have responded.
How would the defense counsel would have responded? One of the arguments is that it would have affected the defense strategy.
Correct, Your Honor.
Play that out and be very concrete and specific as to how the strategy might have changed.
Yes, Your Honor. One of the options available to defense counsel was he could have impeached PFC Palazzo with that clemency recommendation. The Army Court and the military judge noted at that point that would have opened the door for them to admit the prior consistent statement. Again, first of all, that's a decision for the defense counsel to make as to whether to open that door to begin with. They were unable to make that decision in an informed manner because they didn't know the existence of the evidence to begin with. But upon impeaching him with the clemency agreement, if the door had been open and if the government had been able and been ready to respond with the prior consistent statement, at that point, the narrow limitations of the direct examination regarding the four or five questions that they asked as to what DD said, what Coleman's response, the scope would have been broadened.
How else would the accused strategy have been different? Might have been different.
They could have not.
Your first argument was it shaped how you impeached or didn't impeach Palazzo, but is there anything else?
Yes, Your Honor, they could have not adopted the witness, Palazzo as a witness to elicit the additional information. That is information that they could have attempted to get out before the court in another manner. But because they didn't have this information, they adopted Palazzo as a witness and took him on direct to elicit that favorable information.
The defense counsel seemed awfully concerned in trial to keep all of this out. You know, he made a motion, I don't want any of this stuff to go in. Military judge says, okay, fine. And now you're up here arguing, oh, well, he was prejudiced because it didn't come in. Where are we?
Well, Your Honor, that decision, again, was made off of false information. It was based off of...
How false?
Because he didn't know that this agreement existed. Defense counsel...
He had a pretty good idea that something was going on, didn't he? He could have poked and prodded. He could have, you know... It's unclear to me that not knowing the exact contours of the agreement, as opposed to having a pretty good suspicion there's something out there, and knowing the guy was convicted, and knowing that that can go in because he waffled on that. He didn't want it to come in, and then he decided, well, maybe it should come in. So where are we? I mean, I don't get the whole strategy, and I don't get how this admittedly erroneous failure to disclose affected anything.
Yes, Your Honor, I would first note that when Defense counsel asked assistant trial counsel moments before Pilato came in to testify, is there an agreement? And defense and assistant trial counsel gave that response, no, there's nothing in writing. Regardless of whether defense counsel had a suspicion prior to or even had information prior to that there was an agreement, at that point he was entitled to rely on that representation from the government that that evidence did not exist. And the tactical decision he made to prevent the court from the panel from hearing anything about the conviction was based, as he stated in the post-trial 39As, because he didn't want the panel to believe that PFC Pilago was coming in and testifying out of the goodness of his heart, that he was there expecting nothing in return. So that was one of the reasons why it is that he said, I don't want this information to go out in front of the panel. Had he known that there was an agreement, that analysis might have been different. And that goes into, again, whether or not there was a reasonable doubt.
Well, is might have been different enough to carry the... To get around a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, I would draw the court's attention to the Chapman case, the Supreme Court case, where it said whether there's a reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to the conviction. I believe that might have is a consideration in this case. Now, understand...
Well, it might have... You didn't say might have changed matters. You said might have changed tactics.
Yes, sir.
You know, that's another step to what's the effect on the trial.
Yes, sir. It is another step to that point. But again, the analysis here isn't just whether it would have changed the outcome of the trial. The analysis is whether there was prejudice in whether they have proved that it was that didn't harm them beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
In this case, I don't think we can make that determination because there were other tactics and strategies that were available to the defense counsel. And he made those decisions based on false information that was provided by the assistant trial counsel on how to deal with this key and vital witness to the government. The other conclusion that PFC Pilago's testimony was not that important and that it wasn't the linchpin, so to speak, of the government's case. Don't believe that that's an accurate conclusion either, because the government went to great lengths to obtain that evidence when they made this deal with him after he pled not guilty and forced the government to prove their case. They were willing to reduce his sentence by 12 months after they had been forced to prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt against him. That demonstrates the value of his testimony. And also, it's inconsistent for the government to argue, as they did in their brief, that one, PFC Pilago wasn't that important, but two, had his statement actually come in, it would have been so damaging because of the prior consistent statement that there was no way that defense counsel could have possibly responded to that. It's inconsistent. There were options available to the defense counsel to respond to that if they had known the existence of that evidence and been able to make a decision based on an informed manner. Also note that in regards to defense counsel having an idea of the existence of the agreement, again, defense counsel may have had some indication of that prior to, but he was entitled to rely on the representation of the government before that witness came in. I'd also note that in Bank v. Drexler, the Supreme Court stated a rule thus declaring that prosecution may hide and defense must seek has no place in the system of due process. And that's essentially what we have here. The cryptic response from the assistant trial counsel wasn't at that point on the defense to follow up with that. He had already made numerous specific requests for disclosure.
Well, the defense counsel knew that he'd been convicted and sentenced, right?
Yes, sir.
Pilago.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And the judge found that the defense counsel knew that Pilago wanted a deal. Didn't
yes,
the judge right. find that? Yeah. Okay. I still don't see where we get from all of that to it would have been different if he'd known the contour. A, the deal had been arrived at, and B, the contours of the deal.
Well, one of the key issues is that not knowing about it denied them the ability to ask for an additional panel instruction. They could have asked for an additional panel instruction on a witness testifying under
Well, they got a co-conspirator instruction, an accomplice instruction, didn't they?
Yes, sir.
So what more would they have gotten?
I think that's part of the issue, Your Honors. We don't know. We don't know how...
We don't know a lot of stuff, do we?
We don't, Your Honor. And in a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis, it's the defense that gets the benefit of those reasonable doubts, not the government. But throwing an additional panel instruction in front of the panel And as the government responded, another panel instruction could have come in about prior consistent statements. That's two additional instructions that they would have had from the military judge to consider during their deliberations. Specifically, the instruction could have been that PFC Quago testified in exchange for a promise from the convening authority to reduce the sentence the witness received in another court-martial by 1 year confinement. And then there's a follow-up paragraph about how you weigh that, how you consider that. As the Supreme Court said in Brady, we cannot put ourselves in the place of a jury and assume how it is that they would have viewed that evidence. We don't know how the panel would have responded had they been presented with two additional panel instructions.
And just to be clear, the delta is between whatever members understand a witness might or might not get in terms of clemency and the knowledge that the SJ would recommend for clemency.
Yes, sir.
So that's the hinge.
Yes, sir.
And so what do you think members don't understand that someone might testify in the hopes of getting clemency?
I think they do understand it, Your Honor, and I think that also weighs in favor of defense because if they make that understanding, they understand the implications of it as well. But what defense counsel was forced to do was he attempted to argue that PFC Quago was there testifying under a general wish for clemency, a general wish meaning the general system process that we go through after a court-martial is over in which the convening authority
has. Wouldn't members understand that might color how someone testifies?
Yes, Your Honor, but what the government had in its possession at that point was firm evidence that that is what he was doing. He was testifying under a promise or for a recommendation.
So it's a matter of clarity. They didn't get hit the thing home.
Yes, Your Honor. The panel at that point could have thought defense counsel was on a fishing expedition because there was no evidence of it. And I also note the fact that it wasn't in writing and the fact that it was merely a verbal agreement between the SJA and defense counsel.
But counsel, what do you do, though, about the fact that there's a prior consistent statement, right, that if they would have gone down that road, that the prior consistent statement would have showed that long before there was any deal on the table and before he'd been convicted, that he testified exactly how he did at the court-martial?
Defense counsel could have done similar to what he did and attempted to show that he had motive to lie from the moment he walked into CID. Understanding the case law and the standard as to the prior consistent statement doesn't need to predate all motives to fabricate, just the most recently charged one. There's still motive to fabricate when he walked into CID, and it was also after PFC.
Well, I understand that, but that would be your argument, but you're trying to have this, your argument here, I think, hinges on the fact that he wasn't aware of the particulars of the deal from the SJA, right? And that the members would have understood that he would have understood better that he was coloring his testimony in hopes, you know, to get because he got that deal. And my point to you is if he was the same exact thing before there was any deal, how does that help you?
It helps because, again, the defense counsel was denied the ability to make the decision as to whether to open that door to begin with to allow that prior consistent statement to come in. And the Army Court and the military judge also failed to follow that up with the understanding that it was the defense counsel's decision whether to open those doors to begin with, but also if the government had opened the door, taken the action of introducing that prior consistent statement, that would open doors as well. I'd also note that the conclusion that was made by the military judge and the Army Court that the statement was going to be admissible assumes that the government was prepared to offer it. I know we assume that government counsel in general are familiar with the rules and that they are prepared to implement them in a trial context. But in this case, we know that at least they didn't either know the rules of discovery or they in fact disregarded them. So to make that assumption, and I think is incorrect, and it's also inconsistent with the facts, because had the government truly been prepared to introduce that statement, Assistant Trial Counsel would not have made a statement which prevented them from using that piece of critical evidence that they had. The Assistant Trial Counsel statement, no, there's nothing in writing, then precluded them from being able to offer it because at that point, defense counsel had nothing to impeach him with. The idea of using a prior consistent statement did not come out until after the post-trial 39A when government counsel submitted additional written submissions. They argued some prejudice during the post-trial 39A, but they didn't bring out the prior consistent statement until the written submissions after the fact, which shows that at that point was simply a post-trial attempt to show that there was no prejudice. it doesn't support, it doesn't show that they were actually prepared to do it at the time of trial. Again, to conclude that the prior consistent statement was admissible, that was highly damaging, assumes that the defense counsel had no way of tactically responding to that. To the fact that the Army Court impermissibly shifted the burden, as did the military judge, to the defense to prove it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt, as evidence in their opinion when they stated, having been presented with no plausible scenario in which appellant could have benefited from the use of this clemency deal, they affirmed the military judge's determination. That's a demonstration of that impermissible burden shift. I see my time has expired. Subject to your question, this concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. Captain Sasha McKeyser, Major Captain Brandon for the United States. There are two inescapable reasons why the non-disclosure is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. One, the negative effects of impeaching Palago eclipse any good it could have done. And two, even if defense counsel had known, the strategy they employed was the best possible for appellant. Any impeachment of Palago would have been devastating to appellant. An impeachment based on a motive to lie would have had second and third order negative consequences. One, the trial counsel would have been able to simply do rehabilitation potential, or a rehabilitation conversation. That is, that he subjected to perjury, that is, that there's no specific deal by the convening authority, but most importantly, most compelling, is the prior consistent statement, which would have come in both substantively and to rehabilitate Private Palago.
Should we have a different standard when the failure to disclose is intentional than whether you, when it's just negligent or really didn't know you had a favorable statement in your record? I mean, I've seen 100 scenarios in my career. But here they were asked, is there a deal? No, sir, nothing in writing. Isn't that disingenuous?
So I'll answer both of those questions. In this particular case, it's not disingenuous. It's unfortunately opaque based on information they thought the defense counsel knew. But as this court held in Roberts, that both a worst-case scenario prosecutorial misconduct and what we have here, which is that specific request non-disclosure, triggers a very high burden, in fact, that in this case is harmless beyond reasonable doubt, which is not a simple burden, obviously. But in this case, appellant just wants this court to do half the arithmetic. They don't want you to do the other half, which gets you to the answer that they'll keep moving their king into check, so to speak. There is nothing they could have done that the government could have simply rebutted. And I will say this with respect to whether or not the trial counsel were prepared to bring in a prior consistent statement. Palago's statement was a pre-marked exhibit as PE5. It was pre-marked as a defense exhibit, DEF. Everybody knew that the statement existed. It was absolutely reasonable that had the defense counsel at trial impeached him, the trial counsel would have brought in the prior consistent statement, and it would have come in as would have come in both substantively and otherwise. And it would have had the prior consistent statement instruction, which obviously does not help the defense. The best that they could do was the accomplice instruction, which is what they got.
Is there anything in the record that shows us what, how do you pronounce his name, Palago, what he believed the deal was?
There's Palago knew, based on the conversation with the SJ, that there was a recommendation for 12 months. There's nothing to support it that Palago believed that was automatically going to be 12 months as opposed to a recommendation to the convening authority. But Captain Owens, Palago's defense counsel, testified at the post-trial 39A saying, I was good with a handshake agreement, but I knew that the convening authority didn't have to take that as a deal. But Captain Owens specifically said, I knew they could make my guy testify. I was just hoping to get some candy for that.
Yeah, so we don't know from the record what he would have said had he been asked. You're testifying in hopes of leniency, are you not?
That's true statement.
Given all the facts as I understand them, he would have, and had he testified truthfully, he would have said, well, sir, it's my understanding that if I testify truthfully in this case, that the staff judge advocate is going to recommend cutting my sentence.
I think that's exactly what he would have said.
There was no hard deal in this case, was it? I mean, the convening authority hadn't agreed to it.
That's exactly right. One, it's a handshake agreement. Two, it's an agreement for a recommendation, which, of course, the convening authority can disapprove if you chose to. But the other thing that's, I think, important, Senator Cox, that you just pulled out was the additional instruction that would have resulted in, again, they only really want you to do half the calculus. While the instruction for promise for leniency does say you should consider that, note 5, the mandatory instruction, also says he can be punished for perjury, which, that's not a good instruction for the defense. The best instruction is the one they got, which brings me to point number 2.
Counsel, before you get to point number 2, can you just talk about the military judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law? We're reviewing his decision in this case to determine whether he abused his discretion. Is that correct?
Yes.
In terms of paragraph 2 on page 5, which is J244, when the military judge says, I remain convinced that the government's failure to disclose a clemency recommendation was not an intentional act of gamesmanship, is that a finding of fact or a conclusion of law?
Despite where it's located, it's a finding of fact that's also supported by the 1105 submission by defense. They specifically said, we don't believe that this was misconduct, that it was the left hand not knowing what the right was doing, it was miscommunication. So that supports that, essentially what the assistant trial counsel said on the record, which was, I thought they knew. And while it's inexcusable and it's ugly and they should have known, he was unfortunately opaque. There's no harm here. And so, yes, the standard obviously is an abuse of discretion with respect to whether or not the judge erred in denying a mistrial.
So did the defense counsel and did the defense counsel in this case testify at the post-trial 39A?
You know, Judge Ryan, they didn't. And that's, it's interesting because they say we're not going to testify because of some ethics rules that they cite. But what I think is most telling is they say the reason we're not testifying is because we may possess information contrary to our client's interests. That's telling. That means, and that supports the military judge's findings, that defense counsel, if he didn't know the specific contours, he had a darn firm hint. And he knew something. And the reason why he didn't follow up on
So is your argument that the defense has an obligation then to follow up to get Brady material?
No, Your Honor. That's a government burden. Absolutely not. But going to the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt part, the glaringly obvious secondary question to know nothing in writing.
Do you think the military judge has paragraph 2 right with all the burden he's putting on the defense counsel? He does everything but say that defense counsel needs to follow up. You think that's an accurate statement of the law in paragraph 2?
I think in paragraph 2, what he's saying, Your Honor, it is that for the harmlessness piece of this, that's what we're talking about. No, he specifically stated in his findings of fact that it was the government's burden to disclose, and he finds a disclosure violation, and he correctly places the burden on the government.
Additionally, defense counsel cannot willfully and intentionally remain ignorant. So this is an accurate statement of the law of Brady.
It's an accurate statement with respect to whether or not it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not accurate with whether or not...
Where does he say that? Where is it clear in this paragraph this is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis?
Well, he doesn't do it in that specific paragraph, but he does go on to say that what's important about that is that it wouldn't have changed what they were going to do in that case. Because he didn't follow up on it, because he had a firm hint, the not following up is just evidence that it didn't matter. It wouldn't have changed the strategy. And that's how, what we know is ultimately, what the strategy they employed was the best possible one for appellant. Absent Pilato testifying, giving all that great information to the defense, here's the information as it stands before the court. You've got semen, you've got injury, you've got an intoxicated girl who resisted and had a next morning outcry. That's really good information for the government. The great information that the defense got out from Pilato undercut one of the government's theories of guilt, which is that substantial incapacitation. And it brought out this really great evidence of these prior consensual acts that occurred earlier that night, which one allowed for mistake of fact instruction without them having to call their witness to testify. It also got other sources of semen, other sources of injury for them to be able to argue those things. That's great information for the defense. So why would they impeach their own witness? Why would they then, they got this rare opportunity to present a defense without having to put their client up through the crucible of cross-examination. They had a guy up there, they knew the government wasn't going to impeach their own witness. because Palago provided good information for the government. It's corroborating information at the end of the day. Didi was a really good witness. And the defense counsel never cross-examined Didi with respect to those prior sex acts. So they were getting it out through Didi, so who were they going to get it out through? Either their guy, or what they did in this case, which was adopt Palago and get out that very effective information. He gets the best of both worlds. He gets to keep out the ugly CID statement. He gets to keep that favorable information that Palago provided. And then he gets to drop this notion of clemency on closing, where there are no consequences, because the government doesn't have the opportunity to factually rebut it. They just get to sort of drop this thing out there that, oh, by the way, he's convicted he wants clemency, so pay a little, it's dancing on a pin, pay a little bit of attention to him here, but not here. We know they didn't want that information out. We know they didn't want to because in the motion in limine earlier that day, they said, we don't want this information out. And it makes sense why they didn't want it out. They don't want to corroborate Davey's story with a convicted sex assault. They don't want to bring in the fact that it was sentenced, and they certainly don't want to bring in the fact that what the sentence was, because in this case in sentencing, notwithstanding that their guy was just convicted of rape by force, the defense asked for no more than a year confinement. Why would they want to bring out the fact that Palago got 42 months? That's 3.5 years. That far exceeds what they thought they were going to get in this case, even though Palago testified. They got the best of both worlds. It is absolutely the government's burden, and the government should have absolutely told the defense the information. But it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because there's simply no way for the defense to avoid the second, third order negative consequences of impeaching Palago. And because it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied the mistrial. Subject to the court's questions.
I have one more question. The government keeps talking about this prior consistent statement as though it's the great hammer that's going to smash this court-martial to smithereens. And they make the point in particular in the brief that the statement was made before he had a motive to fabricate. Well, didn't he have a motive to fabricate from the get-go? He had a motive to minimize his part in this affair.
Sure. You know, Your Honor, that's a possibility.
But possibility? I'd say it's more than a possibility. It's human nature to want to minimize your criminal liability.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. But here's what we also know. He inculpates himself, like, a lot. He admits that he's a sexual offender. He admits that he continued to put his penis in this girl's mouth after she said no for more than 3 minutes. And so, sure, he has a motive to misrepresent him. But the defense knew that at the time, and they didn't go after that. They didn't go after it because it opens Pandora's box and they know it. They get the best that they can. And his testimony, Palago's testimony, and this statement really just corroborates what Didi already said. So even if they were said he had a motive to minimize, the military judge could avoid that and said, there's nothing in here that Didi doesn't already say. And in fact, this would have brought out more information that would have brought out. The fact that Didi testified that she remembers her hair being pulled, that statement says so, that Walter Coleman pulled her hair.
Counsel, I have a question. The appellant was convicted of 10 years, for 10 years, is that correct?
Originally? Yes, he was sentenced to 10 years.
He was sentenced to 10 years. Do we know why the committee authority cut his sentence to 5 years?
Yes, Your Honor. The convening authority said, among other things, primarily for the sentence disparity between the two. I mean, he found them similarly culpable, and that's why. Subject to any remaining questions, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, please.
First, to address the point Judge Stuckey was making, the judge would have also had found that statement reliable, that blame-shifting statement that was reliable. We don't have that finding on the record because the statement was never offered. In regards to the government's assertion that it was pre-marked, therefore that demonstrates that government counsel was ready to introduced that as a prior consistent statement. There are many reasons why that statement could have been pre-marked. And again, that's not on the record as to why it was pre-marked. It could have been pre-marked because the government didn't know what Pilago was going to testify to when he was up there.
So is your argument actually that we should discount the statement because we should believe that the government wasn't going to be prepared to introduce it? Is that your argument?
No, Your Honor. I think it's a factor. It's a consideration that this court should weigh when determining whether it's harmless beyond reasonable doubt. But I also think it's interesting that talk about the motive to tell the truth, that Pilago had this motive to tell the truth. He had a vested interest in the outcome of this case when he walked in that courtroom. And the fact that his clemency recommendation was unwritten gave him even more of a vested interest, because all he had at that point was a verbal agreement from the staff judge advocate, I'm going to recommend a 12-month reduction. He could have given a good recommendation, or he could have given a great recommendation.
So what statements did he make at trial that were more damning to appellate than were in his sworn statement to CID? With specificity.
Yes, Your Honor. Looking at the 4 to 5 questions that the government listed on direct, they asked him, what did DD say? And he responded, she said stop. And said, what was Coleman's response to that? And then testified the specific statement that Coleman made in response. That was all that the government sought to elicit on direct examination. And at that point, defense, because they didn't know the agreement, was forced to adopt him as their own witness to elicit all the other information. That information could have come out in other ways. So to say that we got the best possible outcome.
How else could that information could have come out?
Could have come out through a testimony of the accused, Your Honor. They could have not adopted him as a witness and made the strategic decision that it would be better for them to get that testimony out from Coleman than it would have been from Pilago.
Isn't that a pretty drastic tactic to put your client on the stand just to get that out?
It is a drastic tactic, but it's a tactic that defense was entitled to be able to weigh in an educated and informed manner, but they were denied that by the non-judge. In regards to paragraph 2 of the Army judge's findings and conclusions, that is an incorrect statement of law because he ignores Banks v. Dredke. And Banks v. Dredke states, our decisions lend no support to the notion that defendants must scavenge for hints of undisclosed Brady material when the prosecution represents that all such material has been disclosed. They made that representation to him moments before Pilago came in. And much like Eshelomi, at that point, it's even worse the fact that they said it doesn't exist, because at that point you're making decisions based saying this evidence doesn't exist at all. So,
counsel, you'd have us believe, and this all happened like in the course of a very short period of time, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And I mean, from what you're saying here today, one would expect that the defense counsel came there fully unprepared to present their case in any way, shape, or form.
Your Honor, not that he was unprepared to present the case.
Whether there was an agreement or there wasn't an agreement, right, he did know that Pilago had just been convicted the day before, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And because he had been involved in it, could they have made him testify?
They could have, which also weighs against the idea that he knew there was an agreement, because they didn't have to make an agreement. They could have just very easily given him an order and told him to go in there and testify, because at that point he'd already been convicted of the offenses. And again, the fact that this was unwritten, that it was merely a handshake recommendation, gave Pilago every motive in the world to maximize his testimony that was there.
But that's what I'm asking you, is how did he maximize his testimony to the detriment of appellant?
Because at that point, Your Honor, all he provided, the only information he provided, was the responses to the 4 or 5 questions that the government asked.
And we just stop there. We don't look at all the information that the defense elicited from him that was favorable.
No, Your Honor, we do. But we look at the fact that the defense counsel made the decision to adopt him at that point based on incorrect information. He formulated a trial strategy based on incorrect information. Defense counsel could have asked for, had trial counsel done the right thing and said, hey, there is an agreement at that point. Maybe he truly believed that he had known, so he said, hey, there is an agreement at that point. Defense counsel could have asked for a recess at that point to then consider what options were available. Defense counsel could have had numerous options sitting waiting for him when he walked into that courtroom and was just waiting for the information to decide which avenue to go. We don't know, because defense counsel was never given the option to make that choice.
But you don't dispute that the defense counsel had an opportunity to interview Pilago before he testified, correct?
I don't dispute that, Your Honor, but I also note that in post-trial 39A, defense counsel for Pilago stated that he had spoken to Pilago and proffered to the court that Pilago never told him that there was an agreement in place. I see my time has expired, subject to your questions.
Any questions for the court? Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel. Case is now submitted, and we'll stand in recess until 9:45.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:15.